A jailhouse informant has a huge incentive to lie.
My cellmate, he's going to kidnap the son of a federal judge.
Jailhouse informants can actually be helpful in stopping crime, preventing crime.
If you love this podcast, I'm sure you're looking for other great true crime podcasts to listen to. Wondery, the network behind this show, has other podcasts for you, especially if you love the way we tell stories here on Best Case, Worst Case. Great shows like Real Crime Profile, Locked Up Abroad, and Hollywood and Crime. All of them are amazing storytellers that you're going to love. If you're looking for more variation in your podcast, like entertainment or audio dramas, they're all available from Wondery. Just head to apple.co/Wondery. That's apple.co/Wondery. Or if you're on Android, head to Wondery.fm. That's
hello and welcome to Best Case, Worst Case. This is your host, Jim Clemente from Los Angeles, California. And with me today from Atlanta is...
Hi, everybody. It's Francie Hakes. Hi, Jim.
How you doing, Francie?
I'm great.
Well, it's great to have you. And again, we are excited to have one of our favorite recurring guests and great friend,
Jim Fitzgerald. Hey, Jim. Hey, Francie. Great to be back with you guys again.
Hi, Fitz. Thanks for joining us again. And Jim and I are on two different coasts. Where are you?
I'm in Cape May County, New Jersey, Barrier Island, and I'm looking out at the bay at one side and the ocean at the other. Beautiful day here.
Well, that's great. Thank you so much for joining us again. Our listeners love it when we have Fitz, the famous red carpet, TV-famed Manhunt Unabomber Jim Fitzgerald on. Today, we wanted to talk to you about something from the Jim Fitzgerald case files. Do you have a case to talk to us about?
I do, Francie and Jim. And Jim was around in this time frame, so he'll know about some of what I'm discussing here. But as you know, I wrote three books so far in my memoir series, A Journey to the Center of the Mind. And in book three, every chapter is kind of a different case that I've worked. We discussed a few of them here. The last long chapter is my role at the Unabomb case. But down around in some of the earlier chapters, I write about some interesting bank robbers I came across. And there's one particular guy that he was a little bit different than the rest of the bank robbers we arrested. And I thought we'd talk about this particular case today.
Well, tell me, Fitz, where in your career were you? Sort of literally, where were you located, and about what's the time frame for this case?
Sure. Well, Jim Clemente and I started in the FBI in November of 87, went through the academy, and we were both assigned in February of 88 to the New York City office, and we were both assigned to the Bank Robbery Task Force. And that was comprised of FBI agents as well as NYPD detectives. We were a great team of men and women who were working a lot of bank robberies at that time, upwards of 500 a year, that we would have to go to all five boroughs and cover. And Jim was on a separate child sexual victimization task force. I would help him out with some cases. He would help us out with bank robberies. So we were always intermingling our various offenses there we were working. And the one that I want to talk about was in the summertime of 1990 in New York City itself.
Well, I can't wait to hear about your bank robbery case. And just so all our listeners know, it's very common for FBI agents to investigate bank robbery. I prosecuted some bank robbery cases when I was a federal prosecutor here in Atlanta. And those cases are often part of a task force. As you said, you've got state and local officials, usually detectives and police officers, part of the task force. Was your task force like that? Did it include state and locals?
No state police, not directly, but it was, we probably had about 10 FBI agents assigned to the case and 10 NYPD detectives. And they had their own sergeant assigned to us. And of course, we had a supervisory special agent. And we worked together very well in teams. And we'd have like at least one day of the week, we'd be assigned to be the first people to go out to respond to a bank robbery. And there was virtually never a day it didn't happen. Then banks in New York in the early 90s started opening on Saturdays, some on Sundays. A lot were staying open every night till 8 o'clock. And bank robberies take no holidays, it seems, and they kept us very busy. I covered three different bank robberies and had to cover leads in all five boroughs in one day in New York. And if you know anything about New York City traffic, that ain't an easy accomplishment. But we did it, and we put a lot of guys in jail at the same time.
Yeah, and remember, Fitz, our first year on the joint FBI-NYPD bank robbery task force, there were 2,000 bank robberies that year.
That sounds close enough to me, and that includes armored car robberies too, of course. Big banks, little banks, you name it, and we were there for all of them.
Well, set the scene for us a little bit, Fitz. You've already given us the time frame and said that you were part of a task force. Tell our listeners what you were doing when the particular bank robbery that you're talking about today came into you.
Well, there was a certain bank robber who was hitting on the Queens Long Island border in the summer of 1990. So the Long Island resident agency, that's the FBI office in that county, they would respond to the ones in Long Island. But it seems about 8 or 10 of them were actually on the Queens side. And we knew it was the same guy. He would go in with a mask sometimes, otherwise not. And we just knew it was one lone offender walking in hand in pocket. He didn't show his gun, but he said he had a gun. One time he went in, and this is the height of the AIDS crisis in the U.S., he walked in and said, I have AIDS, and I'm going to throw liquid on you if you don't give me all your money. So, of course, the tellers turned it over. So we didn't know what we had with this guy. But lo and behold, there was a bank robbery one afternoon in August of 1990, and this guy ran out of a bank, and he saw a police car, ran the other way. He tried to hijack a car from a woman, kind of threw her to the ground, didn't hurt her too bad. But next thing you know, the NYPD pounces on him. And next thing you know, he says he's having a heart attack. And next thing you know, we get a phone call to respond, not to the precinct where he's been arrested, but to the hospital where he's in the ER with alleged heart problems.
So who responds to that, Fitz? I mean, you say we responded to the hospital. What does that mean? Is it a team that goes out?
Good question. And of course, the NYPD always gets the initial bank alarm. And the patrol teams or any detectives assigned out there would go right to the bank and look for the perpetrator, whatever. We then get a secondary call, meaning the FBI task force. I was on rover duty that day, which means you were assigned that whole day to be the one that goes out to the bank jobs. So I teamed up with another detective and we drove out there.
So you and a detective, this is true task force now, FBI agent and detective. So for all those shows that portray dysfunction and disagreement between agencies across the country every day, there are agents and detectives working hand in hand on very important cases. This is a great example. So you and your detective roll out and you head for the hospital. What happens next?
Of course, there's a uniform officer there guarding this patient slash arrestee and handcuffed to the side of the bed. There's a doctor treating him. We walk in. I see the guy. He's about my age. Looks like about my height from what I could tell on the bed. Decent shape, wearing glasses. So I walk over to him. I said, hold up my badge. I'm Special Agent Jim Fitzgerald. This is my partner, Detective so-and-so. What's your problem? The doctor's right there. Didn't read him his rights yet. I didn't think asking his medical condition required me to read his Miranda warnings. So lo and behold, I have this heart problem and my heart's skipping a beat. Doctor, can you excuse us? And officer, why don't you take a little break outside? Sure, no problem. They both walk out the room, me and the detective. I just knew this guy was faking. He did 12 bank robberies already. This is his 12th. And today, when he happens to get arrested, is the day he has a heart problem. So I go right up to his face and say, I know you're lying. I know this is BS. We're not going to keep you here in this hospital room. We're taking you back to 26 Federal Plaza in Lower Manhattan. He kind of looks around and says, you guys are the feds, right? So we both kind of look at each other, yeah. Can I just ask you, why are you going to Rikers Island tonight? That's, of course, the notorious prison in New York City for local and state crimes. So no, you'll be going to the MCC, the Manhattan Correctional Center. Okay, I'll go with you, no problem.
So wait, let me get this straight, Fitz. So he's not really worried about going to jail. He's worried about which jail he's going to?
Oh, that's not the first time someone has told me something like that. They wanted to confirm we're the feds. Can I see your ID again? And I don't think I even showed this guy the second time, but I just convinced him that I knew he was faking. I didn't technically know. I don't have a medical degree, if your listeners don't know that. But this guy just looked relatively healthy. He wasn't covered in sweat. the doctor even told me his signs seemed kind of normal. But of course, who wouldn't be a little bit excited after robbing a bank, trying to hijack a car, running and fighting with the cops, and now you're in a hospital bed. So yeah, your blood pressure may be up a little bit. Long story short, he signed a waiver with the doctor, with the hospital. We put him in cuffs and walked him out. And in the back seat of the car, we were driving in the BQE into 26 Federal Plaza.
Well, so Fitz, I'm really interested in hearing, because I can't help myself, former prosecutor here. When did you read him his Miranda rights?
Oh, we finally did and once we put him inside the car, and he didn't sign it, but he acknowledged he understood it, and we had him sign it back at headquarters. But interestingly, let me give a little time frame to your listeners. Summer of 1970, for some time before that, the Zodiac Killer was striking within the five boroughs of New York. Now, this is not to be confused with the Bay Area Zodiac Killer from the late 60s, early 70s, of course, in San Francisco. This was a New York City guy who sort of called himself that, killed a few people writing letters. So I just want to have your listeners have that as a context. So we're driving back in the car, and the guy, he told us his name was Joey Gallo. And I'm actually making a name up, but that's the name he gave us in the car. And that's the name I use in the book. We're driving in the car, and I actually had a headline next to me of the newspaper that day, something about the most recent Zodiac killing. So this guy, we're just about to enter the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel, and he says to us, guys, I want to tell you something big, but you have to promise once I tell you, you'll handle it for me the right way. And for some reason, I'm thinking, is this guy the Zodiac killer? But somehow, I think we were listening to the radio at the time, the news radio, something about Zodiac. And that's when he pops up and says, I have something to tell you guys, but it has to be in your full, you know, trust, and you can't violate what I'm going to tell you. Okay. Maybe we have the Zodiac killer. So I said, well, what is it? And before we even exit the tunnel, he goes, well, here it is. I know I told you my name's Joey Gallo. Well, that's not true. My real name is Saul Fishbaum, and I'm Jewish. But I'll tell you, I get along much better in prison as an Italian. So can you do me a favor, Agent Fitzgerald? Put me in prison as an Italian?
What? He wants you to book him under an assumed name.
He does. And before we get out of the car that day, I said, I'll tell you what, you cooperate, tell me everything we need to know. I can list that as your alias, no problem. He said, fair enough. We shook hands, I think when I finally took his cuffs off. And lo and behold, he confessed to all 12 bank robberies, including the one we caught him there for today. And the only deal was, could I put him in prison as Joey Gallo instead of Saul Fishbaum? Of course, that's not his real name either. But all I can say is it's a very ethnic sounding name, which was his real name. So I listed Joey Gallo as his real name on the form we had to fill out for his preliminary arraignment, et cetera, actually a warrant for him. And his alias I used as his authentic name. So I just kind of reverse the two so I can keep my word to the guy. If you give your word to somebody, you got to keep up with that. And that's what I did there.
Jim Clementi, have you ever had anything like that happen to you? This sounds very odd to me.
No, I haven't. I did have a police officer once come to me when I was a prosecutor and asked me if I could help him change his name. So this police officer came to me and asked me if I would help him on a personal matter. And I said, sure. You know, he had testified in one of my trials. It was actually his first trial that he'd ever testified in. And he wanted me to change his name because he had a similar name, Jim, to the one you just mentioned. And he wanted to shorten it because he felt that it was too ethnic for him. I believe he was half Jewish, half Puerto Rican, and he wanted to sort of enhance the Puerto Rican part. So I did help him file the application and then represented him in court so that he could change his name, basically. And it became his official name, and it became the name on his name badge and on his police ID.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, obviously, he wasn't changing his name because of concerns of how he might be treated in prison. Fitz, is that basically what Mr. Gallo, a.k.a. Fishbaum, was doing?
That's exactly what he was doing. He made it very clear to me there were no games being played on his part. And And I said, you know what? If you're going to cooperate, people, you know, you give packs of cigarettes to people sometimes if they cooperate. Back in the days when you could still smoke in a federal building, you may get them a sandwich, whatever. You may work out some kind of a deal through the prosecutor's office. For now, all this guy wanted was to put him in under an alias. And I said, you know what? They're going to take his fingerprints because he's been arrested before. He did time in Rikers, which is why he did not want to go back there. So I said, this is all going to come out in the long run. But if he wants to be Joey Gallo for now, I'll put him in as Joey Gallo. And interesting, Francie, this also was unusual about this arrest. It's not too many guys I've arrested that want me to talk to their parents. He had no wife. He had no girlfriend, you know, partner, anything like that. But he wanted me to talk to his parents out in Long Island. So he put me on the phone with them. And I had, well, the good news is your son is okay physically. The bad news is he's under arrest for 12 bank robberies, Mr. and Mrs. Fishbaum. And I'll never forget Mrs. Fishbaum saying, and I won't attempt to imitate the combination Long Island / Yiddish dialect features, but in so many words, I've always wanted my son to get into banking, but not this way.
Oh, my goodness.
And that's right from mom and dad on the phone that night. And so this is only the beginning of the story, too. This guy became my BFF, certainly on a professional level, because he would wind up calling me, Jim. And I know you had prisoners and inmates like this that, and Francie, you probably did too back in your AUSA days, where they just kind of, they see you as their lifeline for some reason, whatever. And this guy would call me, collect, of course, just about, you know, every other day and tell me what his life is. He's now in a drug program, which is good because he had a cocaine issue, which is why he was robbing the banks to buy his cocaine. He also, you know, he was a little bit overweight, so he was working out. He was mid-30s at the time, in relatively decent shape, except for the cocaine usage, whatever. So we have a little rapport building from the night of the arrest. The next week or so, through phone calls, we're waiting his preliminary hearing coming up. And lo and behold, he calls me one day and says, Fitz, I got to tell you, I'm in the middle of something. You got to come over here. We got to talk. All right, Joey, slow down. What's going on? My cellmate, he's going to kidnap the son of a federal judge and maybe kill him. And he's been telling me about this for the last two nights. There's something not right here. I'm a bank robber, but I don't want to hurt any little kids. Okay, what's his name? He gives me the guy's name. In my book, I call him Tony Bag of Donuts. So, and we look Tony's real name up, and he is, in fact, in the MCC awaiting sentencing. He's a mob associate. He's not actually a made guy, but he's definitely a mob associate in one of the New York crime families. So I said, all right, we got something serious going here. I'm going to call you out of General Pop, and we're going to talk and get this done. So stand by.
As everyone knows, buying glasses can be expensive, annoying, and overwhelming. Well, a new company, Warby Parker, has a free home try-on program that I've tried and absolutely love. You can order 5 pairs of glasses, try them on for 5 days. There's no obligation to buy. They ship them to you for free, and they even include a prepaid return shipping label. All you have to do to get your free home try-on 5 pairs of glasses is go to warbyparker.com/bestcase. Warby is WARBY. Parker.com/bestcase. Glasses start at $95, and that includes prescriptions. And for every pair that you buy, one pair is distributed to someone in need. After you go to warbyparker.com/bestcase and place your home try-on order, be sure to go to the iTunes App Store and download the Warby Parker app. They built this awesome home try-on companion feature that allows you to quickly take photos wearing all the frames, stitch it into a video, and share it with your friends and family to pick a winner. I did it. I picked a winner, and I'll post a photo of myself in my Warby Parker glasses on Instagram this week. Go to warbyparker.com/bestcase to get your free home try-on today.
I know it's a real challenge to find people when we're trying to hire them at my business, but ZipRecruiter has made this process so much easier. It's only one click away. ZipRecruiter posts your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards with just one click. Then, ZipRecruiter actively looks for the most qualified candidates and invites them to apply. They even review every application to identify the top candidates, so you never miss a great match. That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other hiring sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on the right candidates finding you. It finds them. No wonder 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes and industries to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, my listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/bestcase. That's ZipRecruiter.com/bestcase. One more time to try it for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/bestcase.
Hi, Best Case, Worst Case listeners. If you like Best Case, Worst Case, I think you're going to really like Suspect Convictions. The hosts are veteran reporters. Scott Reeder is a veteran reporter with 30 years of experience. Willis Kern is also a veteran reporter. And together, they're hosting this new podcast, Suspect Convictions. It's been rated as high as number 2 in the world on iTunes overall charts and is produced in conjunction with National Public Radio affiliates, and it reflects NPR's commitment to quality reporting. The focus of the podcast is on questions of guilt and innocence. They present fascinating cases of potentially wrongful convictions. They're really edge-of-your-seat stories and will have you second-guessing what it means to be innocent until proven guilty. In fact, in season 2, it's a case, an absolutely wrenching case, of the death of a 3-year-old girl. Bart McNeil has been convicted of her murder. I listened to the 911 tape, and even I had trouble deciphering whether or not he was faking. Was he remorseful for what he had done to his daughter? Or were we listening to what it sounded like, a truly grieving father? All these questions and more are discussed in this fascinating new podcast. Suspect Convictions is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and SoundCloud, or you can check them out at suspectconvictions.com. You know, Fitz, this is such an interesting tale in that we have so many people all over the internet and lots of other podcasts and legal commentators who really hate jailhouse informants. In fact, some of them have advocated that police should not be able to use information given to them by jailhouse informants. Jailhouse informants shouldn't be able to testify in a trial. People say that all the time because obviously a jailhouse informant has a huge incentive to lie if what they tell you gives them some benefit because it gets someone else in trouble. So I know you all had policies and procedures about that, about verifying information. So what were you thinking when this informant, because that's what he is now, calls you and gives you this serious information?
That's a very valid point. It's one thing, an arrestee, a defendant, whatever, giving you information about himself. You can verify that in other ways, and they're usually not beneficial to the person if he's admitting to other crimes. But in this case, he's talking about someone else who has a crew out there looking to kidnap the 10-year-old son of a federal judge in the Eastern District of New York. So I go over to the MCC and pull this guy out of General Pop. And that's not always easy to do. You can't just go up to any correctional officer. You want to make sure you get one that you trust. So we did. We pulled him out for like a routine medical exam. It was nothing suspicious. And this guy lays this story out to me, which I found to be unbelievable. But I knew I had to follow through. And the nutshell is, his cellmate, he only knew this guy for a couple of weeks, but since they're both Italians, or at least pseudo-Italian on Stahl's part, they hit it off well. And here it turns out this other Tony Bagadonis was an older guy, and he had a son about Stahl's age. And his son, they were all in for the same truck hijacking case, something like that. And a federal judge sentenced his son to a lengthy sentence, much lengthier than he thought his son should get. So he was really mad at this federal judge, this female federal judge. And he decided if that judge is going to screw with his son, he is going to screw with her son. So what they did is they followed this judge home from the courthouse one day. They knew where she lived. They put a surveillance. Remember, Tony Bagadonis is in jail, but he has his crew out there doing this for him. And they're doing phone calls back and forth to coordinate this. They start coordinating all this, and next they know all this information. He goes and tells them to Stahl/Joey Gallo. Gallo's now telling it to me. He names the judge, where she lives, where the kid goes to school, all this stuff sounds very legitimate. And I knew I had to go tell this judge what was going on. So we put Joey back in General Pop. And my next trip was over to the Eastern District of New York to meet with an assistant U.S. attorney named Charlie Rose. We sat down, confirmed everything that Tony Gallo told me. Next, we had to go see the judge.
So you now have to go see the actual judge and tell her that her family is under threat because she has done her job.
Yes. And we knew, I was certainly a parent then of two young boys, and I knew what this would be like. Certainly for a mother of a child, not to mention a judge. And Charlie Rose, the AUSA working with me, confirmed. We actually went on the computer. Yes, there's a guy named Tony Bag of Donuts. He's in there, and his son was sentenced by this judge. So all this is matching up. And the AUSA just happened to know she has a 10-year-old boy and what his name is, the same as Tony Gallo's telling me. So this is all matching up so far. So Tony called the judge. I think they actually got her out of a court case. The bailiff had to go in and say, it's an emergency. Can you come in? And she doesn't know what this is. We meet in a room. The U.S. attorney himself came into the room back then, and because he found out what it was. And there's like five of us sitting in the room. And I never met this judge before. I never went before. In a sense, I'm saying, Your Honor, you sentenced Mickey Bag of Donuts about 3 weeks ago. Yeah, for a truck hijacking case. You gave him 10 to 15, whatever. Yeah. Okay, well, his father's awaiting sentencing. Yeah, for me too. That's next week. Okay, well, I have some bad news. He doesn't like what you did to his son, so he's talking to a jailhouse informant. He wants to kidnap your son. We don't know exactly what he wants to do. What? And she like drops whatever she's holding. My son? I said, yes. And I start talking about following her home to work, from work to her home, the kid back and forth to school. And she's listening. The AUSA, yes, he's nodding his head. The U.S. attorney himself is in the room. She's nodding. And finally, I said, yeah, the school over in Brooklyn Heights or something. I throw that out. She goes, wait a minute. My son doesn't go to school in Brooklyn Heights. I have a 10-year-old son. But, oh, well, he says you live in, and he names a certain street. He goes, I don't live there. And she goes, oh, my God. And Charlie Rose, the AUSA, oh, my God. You know what this means? This is the gang that couldn't surveil straight. There were two female federal judges, tall, dark hair, late 30s, early 40s, attractive. This gang, this crew, followed the wrong judge home. They were going to kidnap the judge, the son of another judge who wasn't even involved in this case. The U.S. Marshal was also in the room, too, for Brooklyn. And they realized now they had to get details set on the judges and the two kids, on two different judges, two different kids, because this Tony Bag of Donuts crew is actually following the wrong judge's kid and going to kidnap him.
Well, Fitz, that brings up a great kind of behind police lines look, and that is who protects federal judges. And the same goes for U.S. attorneys and assistant U.S. attorneys who might be under threat. And that's the U.S. Marshals, sort of the little unsung agency that hardly ever gets credit for all the brave work they do. And in fact, in the last couple of weeks, a U.S. Marshal was killed executing a warrant, because that's one of the main jobs for U.S. Marshals is to execute fugitive warrants with local task forces. But yeah, the marshal for that district is in charge of protecting the federal judiciary. And once they learn from you of a threat, they would have had to do a threat assessment and take steps to protect that judge or those judges and their families.
And that's what it came down to. It was two judges for the price of one. Of course, no one else knew this. So we had a quick stop, that sort of interview, call the other judge from her chambers. She was brought in, and her almost look-alike sister, they weren't related, but they just had a similar appearance. The one actually holds the hand of the other. All right, Agent Fitzgerald, tell her what you just told me. I repeat the story, but say, Judge, we feel it's your son being followed, because the neighborhood matches up, the school name matches up. And of course, she goes, oh my God, I can't believe this. No. We agreed right then in the room, we're going to go back the next day. We're going to wire up our prisoner, my defendant in the 12 bank robbery cases. We're going to have to secrete a NAGRA reporter on him in an attempt to get information. So what you said earlier, Francie, about prison informants is one thing, them just telling you information and then presenting it in a legal courtroom or in a legal situation somehow. But we knew we couldn't go anywhere with this case without actually getting it on tape. And if you think it's difficult having someone wear a wire just in the general public walking around to a bar, to a store, or whatever, try doing it in prison. But we did it. Tony Gallo agreed to wear the wire. He hesitated at first. "Why can't you just wire up my jail cell?" he said. And we found out that it's very difficult to do that. And other people would speak and talk. He wore the wire. He caught Tony Bag of Donuts saying everything that I had heard the day before, still convinced they were following the right judge and the right judge's kid in their definition of the right judge. So we took the tape, listened to it. Everything matched up. Now we had to figure our logic and our strategy of what to do now with Tony Bag of Donuts.
Well, now you have a whole new case. I mean, you started with a relatively simple bank robbery case where you had a confession, and now you've got a conspiracy from inside and outside the jail to commit kidnapping of United States District Judge's son.
And they may have even had the wrong judge on top of all that, and the wrong judge's kid, so which made it even more complex. So we went back later that day with the tape. We cut out snippets of it so the judge could hear this. Both judges, the U.S. attorney, they brought both their husbands in. I think at least one of the husbands was himself a lawyer. So I'm sitting with this, very esoteric group, but parents very concerned about their kids. And the bottom line we laid out, and quite frankly, I was just kind of an observer when they came up with the strategy, but let's call Tony Bag of Donuts. We'll writ him out, bring him over to the Eastern District of Brooklyn, and we'll interview him, and we'll basically read him the riot act and see how he reacts. So the very next day, we bring him out. We get some of his phone calls, by the way. They're all recorded in prison. We listen to them. Again, it matches up with what we already knew. And we bring him in. He's kind of a tough guy, a mob, not a soldier, but he's a wannabe. He knows all the bigwigs, and he tries to play the tough guy at first. And then lo and behold, between me and Charlie Rose, we just read him the riot act. Know what he's up to, what his crew is up to involving the judge. We didn't bother to correct him that he had the wrong judge. We didn't feel there was any real logic in that. At first, he denied it. At first, then he backed off. "Oh, you know, my son got sentenced. You believe he got 10 to 15 for a truck hijacking? Right here to talk about your son." Long story short, he admitted it. He said he was never going to hurt the kid. He was going to have his crew drive him up to the Bronx or some other part of Queens, wherever. Drop the kid off in like a so-so neighborhood and let him get home on his own. And as they drop him, I'll say, "You better tell your mother, she better be more fair when she sentences people." Words to that effect.
Yeah, but even that is a major crime.
Of course. And he knew that. I think because this was all sort of in-house between the U.S. attorney working down, I'm sure the attorney general in Washington, D.C. was made aware of this. And they decided they were going to not charge him with the potential kidnapping or the conspiracy to kidnap, but instead just do an upward departure on the sentencing guidelines for the truck hijacking he was already in there for. So we discussed all this in an open forum in the courthouse chamber that day with the U.S. attorney and all the other interested parties, and I didn't disagree with what they came up with. They wanted to keep their kids out of court. They didn't want the judges having to be witnesses here. So I understood them to a degree. Of course, the initial judge recused herself from any further dealings with Tony Bag of Donuts. And it turns out he was eventually sentenced. And this case was brought up in front of the new judge. And with the upward departure from the guidelines, I think he got 25 to 30 for the truck hijacking itself, as well as the planned kidnapping. And of course, he was a prior felon. So this all added up against him. And but the one important deal I did want to cut, though, I had to get my informant out of that prison because it would all come together. Everybody would know who it was. And sure enough, we did that. We moved to another prison and never had a problem with that particular guy or his crew again. So Joey Gallo finally had his day in court. And just the opposite of what happened to Tony Bag of Donuts, this was a downward departure in his bank robbery case. They wound up giving him 5 to 10 years for each bank robbery, but they were concurrent and not consecutive. And as you know, that makes a big difference because all the time is basically served at once. So his sentence was relatively minimal for having committed 12 bank robberies, but then he may have also saved the life of a judge's 10-year-old son. So he went out to a Western federal prison, wound up talking to some bikers, and he became an outlaw biker types. And he wound up becoming an informant for me in that regard. And we actually got him out of prison a little bit early, and he did some work for us in the New York City area with some bikers. But unfortunately, he got hooked up on coke again, and we had to cut our ties there, and he's moved on. But interestingly, over the next 10 years, I would hear from the fish bombs on occasion. Even after I left New York and went to Quantico as a profiler, they tracked me down, and they would call me about their son and why he wouldn't call them, and could I call him and have them make a return call. I said, look, Mrs. Fishbaum, I know you always wanted him to get into banking, and it seems like right now he's not in banking. Maybe that's a good thing, but I really can't help you anymore. So I lost complete track of him. But to his credit, besides admitting to what he did when he committed the bank robberies, he also may have saved the life of a federal judge's son. And to that, I'm always appreciative of him. So even the worst of criminals and felons who do jail time, some of them have good in them. And this guy saw that, you know, some kid may be hurt, and he didn't want that to happen. And if he could do anything about it, he would try to stop it. And he did. And everyone's better for it.
Wow, Fitz, that's a pretty amazing story. And it does show how jailhouse informants can actually be helpful in stopping crime, preventing crime, and also convicting people who are doing bad things. I do have to echo what Francis said, and that there are cases in which so-called jailhouse informants actually are literally only taking advantage of a situation to try to improve their own lot, and they make up stuff, and they have many times been proven to be liars. So I think when you use jailhouse informants, there's a responsibility to verify every fact and really vet the information that they give you, because sometimes it's just self-serving and completely false. And I thank you too, Fitz. It's always great to have you on Best Case, Worst Case. And I hope we continue to do some amazing things in Hollywood. And it's great to call you a friend. Take care.
You're welcome. Again, it's all in my book, A Journey to the Center of the Mind, Book 3, along with a bunch of other cases. So, yeah, I'll be glad to come back on any time.
Well, that wraps it up for this episode of Best Case, Worst Case. Thank you for listening.
Best Case, Worst Case is an XG production. Produced by Jim Clementi at Empire Studios, LA. Engineered and edited by Mike Thal. Music composed and performed by Simba Tsumba. And hosted by Wondery.
You can listen to Best Case, Worst Case on your favorite listening app. We are on Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
If you want to do something about child sexual abuse, Darkness Delight can help. Did you know that more than 90% of the time children are sexually abused by someone they know?
Jim, this isn't about stranger danger. It's about learning the true risks. Darkness to Light's training can help prevent, recognize, and react to child sexual abuse in your community.
When you make the decision to get involved, kids can be protected. It starts with you.
Visit www.d2l.org to take the training and learn more.
That's D2L.org.